really make me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing hot and low. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the bolts are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, wishing you a good evening. And I have, as always, the great, great honor of my good friend, Brooke Hines, with us tonight. Boom. So join me in welcoming the real nitty gritty girl, Brooke Hines. Brooke, welcome.
Hey there.
How are you tonight? It has been one more of those consistently crazy weeks here in Air America.
I'll tell you what, I hope things get on the upswing for everyone. I know that it's been a rough week for a lot of folks. And you know what? The weather's just had a lot of people down here in Florida. We've been socked in with just the kind of weather that I'm used to seeing in Tennessee. This is not Florida weather. This is Smoky Mountains weather. So it's about time that it just blew away, so to speak.
It would be nice.
Yeah. You know, it was also a weird week. You know, last week we talked about Donna Brazile's new book, Hacks, where she spends part of her book or half of her book talking about the hacks in the form of computer hacks, ostensibly from the Russians, we think, or she thinks. And the other half of her book talking about the other kinds of hacks, which were the hacks that holed themselves up in Brooklyn and worked for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And then this week she spent, Donna Brazile spent a whole big deal of the book, you know, saying that, well, you know, I never meant to say that any of those hacks rigged the campaign against Bernie Sanders. And, you know, a lot of people found that to be interesting, and then a whole lot of people, you know, took those took quotes and made memes and you know, went out on social media correcting the record, so to speak. You know, maybe some of them were paid, some were just doing it for the heck of it. You know, what did you catch any of that action this week, Rick?
Well, you know, I always think, and you know, whenever I see Democrats acting like Republicans and kind of tearing plays from the Republican playbook, you know, it always makes me wonder, how is it that when you quote from somebody's book, you're mischaracterizing their statements? You are taking these things out of context. Well, I'm going to try an experiment. I got one of my robot buddies to record a little segment from Ms. Brazile's book. This is a lift from Politico where it was published. These excerpts were published. And I'm going to let my robot give this a try. This is reading from Politico, Donna Brazile's excerpts. Did you hear that okay?
No.
Oh, you didn't hear it at all. Okay, let me give one more segment a try. Did you hear any of that?
No, I've got the article right here. If you tell me where to start from, I can read for you.
Oh, you know, the The little segment that I wanted to have the robot read, and unfortunately, once again, the technical interface of our show is still giving us little hiccups. But let me read a segment, and then you can read a segment, because there's so much interesting content in there. Again, you know, keep in mind, this is an excerpt from Donna Brazile's book, published in Politico. The first segment that caught my eye goes something like this. Before I called Bernie Sanders, I lit a candle in my living room, put on some gospel music. I wanted to center myself for what I knew would be an emotional phone call. I had promised Bernie that when I took the helm of the Democratic National Committee after the convention, that I would get to the bottom of whether Hillary Clinton's team, not Hillary, but her team, had rigged the nomination process as a cache of emails stolen by, quote, Russian hackers, quote, and posted online had suggested I'd had my suspicions from the moment I walked in the door of the DNC a month earlier, based on the leaked emails. But who knew if some of them might have been forged? I needed to have soundproof, and so did Bernie. Now, talk about a bizarre, twisted provenance. These are, you know, they're hacked emails stolen by the Russians. Who knows if they're true? Well, wait a minute. If they're written by campaign professionals, don't other campaign professionals know whether they're true or not? I find that really curious. Any reaction?
One way to find out.
You could ask.
One way to find out, they could have provided access to their email server, and they could have cleared that right up, but they never did that, did they?
No. Well, you know, sometimes it's important that facts don't really get involved. What we want is conjecture and supposition. Here's another little segment that I thought was really, since our good friends in the upper echelon, the rare, refined air of the top of the party, think about money so much. I thought this was an interesting paragraph. So I followed my predecessor, Florida Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, had not been the most active chair in fundraising at a time when President Barack Obama's neglect had left the party in significant debt. As Hillary's campaign gained momentum, she resolved the party's debt and put it on a starvation diet. Now, that seems like the way you want to enter a campaign season, right? It had become dependent on her campaign for survival. Obviously, that was a coincidence, for which she expected to wield control of the operations. Debbie, thrown under the bus here, was not a good manager. She hadn't been very interested in controlling the party. Now, isn't that someone you'd really want to have in charge of a party? Someone who's, you know, not really interested in fundraising or interested in running a party? That's the kind of person you want to have in charge, right? But it goes on, and credulity will be strained further when she says, she let the Clinton headquarters in Brooklyn do as it desired, so she didn't have to inform the party officials how bad the situation was. You see, Brooke, these poor little dears, they've never really been concerned about fundraising after all, and they were completely blindsided, don't you think, by the terrible state of the economics of the party.
You just connected two pieces right there that are absolutely key. When you said in the prior paragraph, it had become dependent on her campaign for survival. The DNC had become dependent on her campaign for survival. Donna Brazile wrote that sentence very passively as if, oops, the DNC accidentally became dependent on this campaign for survival, the way that people become accidentally addicted to drugs somehow. That's not what happened. In 2014, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, along with Perkins Coie, attorney Mark Elias, they sat down and they wrote up the contracts that made this agreement. And that happened in 2014, a year before 2015, when all of this campaigning, pre-campaigning even started. It was deliberate. And they wanted the campaign in debt. They wanted all of these pieces in place for this to happen. It wasn't like, oh, my God, we're in debt. What do we do? It didn't happen like that. And the way that Donna Brazile sets this up, you know, like it's all passive language. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz was a terrible manager who had no idea what was going on, and it was all out of control. That is absolute rubbish. It wasn't out of control, and it wasn't because she was a terrible manager. She knew exactly what was going on. She was in meetings with all of these people, making sure that the documentation, that the contracts were being drawn up, and that this organization, that the structure was there, and that these financial arrangements were being made long before 2015, 2016, and now it's 2017 when the story is being told. And it's being told in a watered-down kind of, you know, half-assed way that, you know, some people are shocked about. You know, some people in the establishment, Democratic wing of the party, you know, might be clutching their pearls right now or fainting on their fainting couches, thinking, oh my God, what's become of my party? You know, but the other half of the party is going, no, really, this is only part of the story. It's much worse than that.
You know, it strains credulity to such an extreme extent, because it seems to me that one doesn't become the new interim temporary leader of a party without being kind of tight with those at the top. So to suggest that this was a complete shock is just, well, it's absurd on its face. There's one more segment I want to... Go ahead.
Well, we all know what a fall guy is, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz has become the fall guy. You know, she is the person who is falling on the sword for all of this nonsense, for this whole narrative to be able to stack up. And by the way, this last week we're finding out, you know, Donna Brazile is finding out how her story is needing to be massaged and reworked in order to kind of make sense again, because the way she's presented it in the book it's not being received by the establishment. It's not really being received by the progressives. So now she's kind of coming up with like a third story that is kind of acceptable to some and maybe both. And for the elections on Tuesday, the narrative that she had come up with, which was getting some play on MSNBC, and she was leaving with a big grin on her face, was, see, I was right. We needed to send money to down-ballot races, and that Hillary Victory Fund was sucking that money out of those down-ballot races. And you know what? She's right about that. And that was a problem. And she actually, you know, if she's going to bring that to the fore and identify that as a problem and that actually get addressed and stay addressed in the Democratic Party, then more power to her. But go ahead. I know that there's more you want to address in this piece.
Well, you know, there's so many things in this that just, you know, don't pass the smell test. Another one that I thought was kind of interesting was, so you're being placed in charge of a major American campaign organization. And she says, she asked, what's our expenses? Well, You know, I don't think one would undertake an enterprise without having a clear sense of the checks and balances, what the accounts receivable, accounts payable was. And so she says, so I asked him, what's the burn rate, Gary? How much money do we need every month to fund the party? And this innocent, she must have been so innocent. She certainly was completely taken aghast when she learned that, well, the burn rate was $3.5 million to $4 million a month. I gasped, she said. I had had a pretty good sense of the DNC's operations after having served as interim chair 5 years earlier. Back then, the monthly expenses were half of that. Well, what had happened? The party chair usually shrinks the staff between presidential election campaigns, but Debbie had chosen not to do that. She had stuck lots of consultants on the DNC payroll, and Obama's consultants were being financed by the DNC too. When we hung up, I was livid, she says, not at Gary, but at the mess that she had inherited. Now, you know, I think if you were in charge of a small grocery store, you were the new person in town, you'd want to know, what's my overhead? What's our payables? To imagine that Debbie had on her own stuck a bunch of consultants in there and run up a big deficit on her own when she wasn't, let's see, was it she was adding people or she was not interested? Was it she didn't want to be in charge or she was in charge? Was she in charge and hired consultants or was she not involved at all and outsourced at all? Which of these lies is the one you want to go with? Because, honey, you're telling lots of stories. Last thing I was going to say was this, which I think is really, really kind of interesting. It says, when the party chooses the nominee, the custom is that the candidate's team starts to exercise more control over the party if the party has an incumbent candidate, as was the case with Clinton in 96 or Obama in 2012. This kind of arrangement is seamless because the party is already under the control of the president. But when you have an open contest without an incumbent and, quote, competitive primaries, the party comes under the candidate's control only. Wait a minute. How competitive is it when one candidate has already gotten the keys to the kingdom, when the contracts say any monies are going to be flushing through them? Boy, I'll tell you, they really, I mean, it's one thing to say that an organization can't keep its story straight. Honey, Donna can't keep her story straight that she's telling. It's bizarre.
Well, you know what else is bizarre is that she's claiming all of this ignorance of the way that the DNC handles their finances. Coming in as chair, but she was a vice chair. She was a vice chair of the DNC. I mean, she was just like promoted. It was just a half step up. I mean, like as a member of the executive,
a real
board,
outsider, in other
you
words.
Should be a little bit more familiar with the way that your organization is being run. It shouldn't be a complete shock when you hear what the burn rate is. It shouldn't be a complete shock when you know when you find out that consultants are being hired. You should be a little bit more familiar with the operations. I mean, that actually was very shocking to me in reading this piece and in reading the book itself, is that somebody who is on the executive board as a vice chair is actually paying no attention at all to the organization itself. You know, so, you know, if Donna Brazile as a vice chair is paying absolutely no attention to the DNC, why should Debbie Wasserman Schultz be paying any attention to the DNC? You know, I mean, she's answered her own question right there.
And, of course, it's not that we're about to undertake another campaign, is it? And it certainly isn't that, if you can't fight the Republicans that can't do any legislation, that the few things that they actually say they're going to do and pretend that that's what people elected them for are absolutely against the best interests of the country. The country wants health care. They're in it. The country needs to have tax relief. They need to get tax revenues up. And again, they're offering us the same trickle-down, which I mentioned that they did not run on. They did not say, we're going to give more trickle-down because that's the way the working people are going to benefit. We said they promised when they ran this bozo, the Trumpster, they said it was going to be working families getting the relief, not the rich. I guess that didn't work so well when it came up against the Koch brothers' agenda, did it?
Not so much. Not so much. You know, it's the Democrats have a lot to answer for. And Tuesday night, I think a lot of Democrats breathed a sigh of relief on Tuesday night. You know, we got a lot of good news out of Virginia, right? You know, so Northam, the so-called Democrat who voted for George W. Bush not once but twice, was elected by a large margin, and that's great. You know, there's a ostensible Democrat, and not Ed Gillespie, who is the former head of the Republican, the RNC, the leader of the Republican Party. So Ed Gillespie will not be the governor of Virginia. Yay. Northam's a goofball. You know, I'm glad he's governor. I wish that his primary opponent had won. But now check this out. When the Bernie-crat Perillo lost to Northam, I want every, you know, Hillary person, you know, who makes it their hobby in life to attack Bernie-crats to understand this and to take this to heart. Perillo went out and campaigned for Northam like there was no tomorrow. You know, he made it his second job. All right. So, you know, it wasn't like there was no way that you can say in Virginia that the progressives and the establishment like cleaved apart. But the other thing that happened, and where you can say that there was a cleaving, was that the establishment Democrats found it very difficult to give support to down ballot Democrats that they found to be too progressive. And one in particular, Lee Carter, won his race, and he was way too progressive, and he wasn't going to win, according to the Democrats, because he was too pro-labor and, this and that. And so he got support from DSA, from Democratic Socialist America, and from Our Revolution, and he won that race, you know. As a matter of fact, Tuesday was a very good night for Bernie's organization, Our Revolution. They won, at least as of Wednesday morning, the count was 21. They had won 21 races. There were still a few outstanding as of Wednesday morning, and waiting for those counts to come in. And DSA members had won 15 races, okay? That is a lot of down-ballot races for these not-a-Democrat, you know, kind of people. You know, and you know, let it be known that a lot of people who are getting support from Our Revolution and from DSA are running as Democrats. A lot of them are not running as independents or no party affiliation, and so on and so forth. But in Virginia, these Our Revolution types and DSA types just really kicked butt. And then, you know, you move over to the Philadelphia district attorney's race, and you had the unelectable Larry Krasner, who was a career defense attorney and a critic of mass incarceration who supports Black Lives Matter, beating out the Republican candidate by 40 percentage points. You know, this is the kind of stuff. This is a wave. This is people saying, okay, we've had enough. We're awake now. We are awake now. And that is something that we need to take to heart for 2018. And if there are people out there who are sitting on the fence, who are our revolution types or DSA types, who are thinking about, you know, getting into a school board race or a city council race or a county commission race, and you're like, I don't know, you know, do it. You know, in Florida, there should be none of these like unopposed races. And we have a history of Republicans running unopposed. It happens all the time. And I'll tell you what. You know what race is going to be interesting, the one that I want to watch in 2018?
Which one?
Is the Tim Canova, Debbie Wasserman Schultz race.
Awesome.
Because nobody is more wounded right now than Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And it's...
You mean other than incompetent and corrupt?
Exactly. And, you know, there is no reason that a Democrat in her district needs to pull the lever or fill in the bubble for Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Tim Canova is a capable, smart, and you know, not corrupt person. And he deserves that seat. He's done all the work. He is somebody that can be trusted, and he's somebody who has the ability to do the work of the people in a straightforward manner that we haven't seen coming out of that district in many, many years. I think Debbie Wasserman Schultz started out her career as a much different politician than she is now. And that's sad. I hate that happens to people. But I guess it does, you know. I guess it takes you through the meat grinder. I think you have to, you know, compromise and maybe come out the other end a different person. It's time for a change, you know. Maybe it's time for her to go and do some lobbying or something, but it's time for a change in that district. That district is too blue to go for a Republican, and it's Tim Canova's time, I think, and especially the listeners to this program need to take Tim Canova seriously. They need to get behind him, donate, and volunteer for his campaign. That is my pitch for tonight for Tim Canova, but I am super serious about this candidate for 2018 in a way that I wasn't in 2016. I felt that he was just going to win in 2016. To be perfectly honest, I just thought it was going to happen. How much more time do we have before you want to roll your recorded?
We got 5 or 10 more minutes for sure. No sweat.
Well, let me pivot for a second. You know, we've talked about Donna Brazile and this stuff going on within party, and I want to pivot a little bit and talk about media, media in general, because there's been some stuff go on over the weekend that is like candy to me. I can't stop just putting it in my head, you know, and what I'm talking about is this compulsion some folks have on social media to go after journalists and comedians that are operating on the platform of RT, Russia Today, or Russia I don't know what the T stands for, RT. And, you know, specifically, I think that we're talking about Lee Camp, who does a show called Redacted, and another person who was attacked this weekend is Abby Martin, whose show was called Empire Files, I believe, but she's no longer on RT. And just to fill everybody in, Michael Ian Black, who is a comedian who's done movies and stuff, but I know him from The State, which was on MTV, a sketch comedy, and a young comedian named Jenna Friedman, who is a producer on The Daily Show. She's a 2005 graduate of Northwestern University. She graduated in anthropology,
wow,
doing her senior thesis in comedy, which is how she broke into the business.
Cool.
She might have done well to maybe study some history or political science, because she's taken it upon herself to be a one-woman, to host a one-woman McCarthyite witch hunt against Lee Camp and Abby Martin. And so her and Michael Ian Black have, like, you know, kind of tag teamed and decided that, you know, they're going to root out the pinko commies in independent media, you know, because, like, you know, Putin somehow stole the election and these people are evil. And so it's gotten really ugly. And, you know, like, every once in a while, I don't try to pay attention to this stuff, but every once in a while you just kind of see it and you can't look away. Today was one of those days. I saw it and I couldn't look away. And what really caught my eye was how very nasty these public figures were being. Jenna Friedman in particular was being exceptionally nasty to Abby Martin. And Abby Martin, if anybody isn't familiar, she is an unbelievably dialed in journalist who covers, like, foreign policy. And she had a very public, divorce, you would say, with RT a long time ago. So she's no longer associated with RT. Lee Camp is a comedian. And so Michael Ian Black and Jenna Friedman are very concerned that Lee Camp hasn't done any, I guess, comedy sketches on RT that are critical of Vladimir Putin, which actually isn't true. He's had Pussy Riot on, and he's, you know, done a lot of this and that. But actually, Lee Camp's Redacted Tonight, the name of the show is Redacted Tonight. Redacted actually refers to the redaction, like CIA redacting, which is like security state, which is like an American thing. And then all of this kind of folds in upon itself, because what we're really talking about is the kind of, you know, COINTELPRO kind of counterintelligence operation that the security state would use to quell dissent on the left at the behest, you know, like they did back in the 50s, and they're doing right now, this very minute, through people like Michael Ian Black and Jenna Friedman, you know, people who would go to big fancy colleges like Northwestern and major in anthropology and do your thesis in comedy and then just happen to become a comedian and be on The Daily Show, because, like, life is super easy like that. All you have to do is do your thesis in comedy, and then you become a comedian and get on The Daily Show. Well, you work at Booz Allen Hamilton for a little while, but then you get on The Daily Show. Life is super easy like that, because, like, my parents are super rich, you know, like that. But, so here's the thing. Lee Camp is a useful idiot. And everybody needs to know that, and they need to stop watching his show, and they need everyone to know that if they watch his show, that their social media account might possibly get flagged, and Twitter might not like that. So what I'm doing here is just a little bit of theater, and I'm trying to get everybody to understand that this kind of stuff is exactly the stuff that happened in the 50s. It sows paranoia, you know? Mm-hmm. It makes people feel like they can't talk about things that are important. And it is especially pointed towards the left, right?
Of course.
This is what J. Edgar Hoover wanted. J. Edgar Hoover wanted to expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, neutralize, and otherwise eliminate the left. And that's exactly what's going on with RT. Now, they're right now, they're aiming it at RT. But you can see from the tactics that they're using, you can see that the strategy behind that is today it's RT. You know, tomorrow it's going to be Truth Dig. And the next day it's going to be Alternet. And the day after that, it's going to be, let's say, Salon. You know, it's you know, it becomes generalized. And you start with a news organization that everyone's like, I don't know, they're kind of sketchy. And then the next one is like, oh, they're associated with those guys? Well, I kind of like them, but boy, if they're associated with those guys, then I can't listen to them. And it keeps going like that, you know? And pretty soon, you find that nobody on the left is worthy of being listened to because, oh, my God, they're all Putin puppets. Who knew? And what's so amazing about this, we're in the second week of November. Well, it just so happens to be that a year ago, on Thanksgiving Day, the very day that everybody was sitting down for Thanksgiving dinner, the Washington Post ran a story above the fold talking about a shady organization called Proper Not. Now, nobody takes Proper Not very seriously anymore. It's really fallen by the wayside because the story that Washington Post ran was roundly dismissed and discredited. But there for a little while, people were like, oh, my God, there's this thing called Proper Not. And they had this list, this media blacklist of 100-plus alternative news sites. And it included Truth Dig, and it included Naked Capitalism and Counterpunch and all of these left-wing sites that they were saying were useful idiots of Vladimir Putin. Exactly what I'm talking about right here. Now, what they did, what Proper Not did that was stupid was they took like 10 steps too far, and everybody pushed back and said, hey, you can't do that. That's ridiculous. Now, so they backed up. Proper Not went away, and a new group has emerged, a whole new group. They've emerged. They're called Alliance for Securing Democracy. And they're doing something totally different, but it's exactly the same. And they have a dashboard called the Hamilton 88, no wait, sorry, 68. The Hamilton 68 dashboard. And if you go to AllianceForSecuringDemocracy.org or whatever, you can go to their dashboard and you can see all of the Russia trending topics. You can see what all the bots of Russia topics and URLs and fake news, you can see what's trending. And the funny thing is if you go there and you look at all their charts and stuff and what's trending and everything, you might as well be looking at a collection of words that are like Russia, MAGA, the word from, the word eat. It's useless information. It's absolutely useless information. Every once in a while, they'll throw in a couple words where you're like, what's up with that? And it'll be like Saudi princes or bombing in Syria. It'll be very specific things that just happened that have to do with foreign policy. And you're like, wait a minute, that's awful specific. Like all of a sudden, right after they're just talking about all this general stuff. And what emerges is, to me, and you know, I don't want to get too far afield, but these organizations, Proper Not, Alliance for Securing Democracy, there's a lot of evidence that these guys are basically the same people that were behind the kind of groups like COINTELPRO, same kind of people that J. Edgar Hoover was using to expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, neutralize, and otherwise eliminate the left. It's the same people. Now, you don't have to listen to me talk about it because somebody else has done the work. Thank God. I don't have to do all the work on this. What you need to do is get online and go to Alternet. And on Alternet, there's a fantastic investigative news program or project called the Gray Zone Project, and that's G-R-A-Y Zone, not E-Y, A-Y, Gray Zone Project, and it's Max Blumenthal. So Max Blumenthal, he's the one who's doing all this fantastic writing. I'm just going to check that out. Alter that. And make sure that I'm giving you the right writer there. And while I'm doing that, I'm going to give you another tip. If you're on Twitter, you must follow for this week. Follow Ben Norton. Follow Max Blumenthal. Follow another writer whose name is Yasha Levine. Y-A-S-H-A, Levine, L-A-V-I-N-E, and follow Mark Ames, M-A-R-K-A-M-E-S. These four people are, this is kind of your core group of folks that are going to keep you informed and not steer you wrong on all of this stuff that's going on with this rising McCarthyism. These guys are doing real journalism. They're doing real investigations, and no bullshit. You know, these are the tools that you need in order to make the decisions on your own. This is not people making up your mind for you. So Max Blumenthal, Ben Norton, Yasha Levine, and Mark Ames. Also, alternate, go to the Gray Zone Project. That's where all of this investigative reporting is happening, and you don't want to miss it. So that's what I wanted to get in under the wire before you started your pre-recorded stuff.
Well, thank you so much, Brooke. As always, you always bring us thought-provoking material with your keen insight and incredible experience analyzing the political world. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Talk to you next week.
Okie doke. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Next up, we've got some very lovely material. We did an interview with Aria Ligi. She's a tremendous poet and also a web publisher and teacher. She has done some recent publishing that you need to know about, and you need to know this poet's work. So here she is, Aria Ligi. Fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, I have the great honor and privilege to bring to you the voice of a tremendous poet, an extraordinary poet, a writer who has covered from ancient tributes of poets past to modern contemporary issues. Of course, I'm talking about the poet Aria Ligi. Aria, welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's such a great honor to have you back again. I have admired your work for a long time, really enjoy it. And I understand that one of your pieces has been selected for an edition of Poets from the New York area. Why don't you tell us a bit about that edition, and then we'll talk about your piece.
Well, it's from a publication called Z Publishing. And what they're doing is they are putting out books from every state, so New York is just one of them, in which they have the best of emerging poets. And so there was a California edition, Georgia edition, all the way through the United States. And then from that, selecting 3 to 5 poems and of the best. So in other words, you know, see how many clicks each poem gets and looking at all the reviews. And from those 3 to 5, they're going to pick one poem, and that poem will receive a $500 award and a book deal.
Wow.
So it's pretty much a big deal. Yeah.
That's pretty nice. I imagine that there's some really extraordinary work in that collection. Before we talk about the particular piece that you've contributed to that, I also wanted to point out that you're involved in another publication as well, and you are currently soliciting poetry from other poets for the magazine that you're closely involved in. Why don't you tell us about that, and tell us about that date as well?
Well, the magazine is called New Poetry. I've been with them since their inception in 2014. And right now we are currently accepting submissions for our new edition, which will come out in February of 2018. And the guidelines are pretty much standard. You know, we accept, you know, mostly metered verse, but we do accept free verse. But as I would say, the quality of the free verse has to be exceptional, because our lean is more towards classical writing. And let's see, and the deadline is midnight, December 18th. And anybody who wants to submit can email me directly at aria@newpoetry.net.
Awesome. Well, let's go back to that collection that you're involved in of New York poets. And what's the title of the piece that they published?
The title of this one is called Ordination Rite. And I should tell you, because, you know, we're on the radio and you can't see it, but Rite is spelled R-I-G-H-T. So it's a play on words, because there is an ordination rite, R-I-T-E, which is a very religious rite. And so it's a play on that thought.
And let me ask you this. Is it a meditation or a treatment of a particular one, or just the concept of, if you will, of ritual and of that, should we say, achievement of some spiritual level?
No, not at all. Right, not at all. This poem is actually part of a book that I wrote called Hammer of God. And I wrote this following the death of my mother. And it really was a cathartic experience for me to write this book, because it really deals a lot with abuse. And as a survivor myself, I had hoped to create something that other abuse survivors could read and reflect and identify with. I also think, because of all of the Me Too stuff coming out right now, it's actually really good timing, which of course was not intended on my part. But my hope is that it will speak to other men and women who have gone through abusive situations.
Ah, the spirit of serendipity strikes again. So, well, can I impose upon your good nature to read the piece aloud?
Sure. And just to let you know, I've had a few people ask me from the first two lines, you know, what does this mean? Well, you have to think sort of in exclamation terms. So in other words, somebody is, they're exclaiming rather than just, you know, saying it. So it's, you know, kind of like ahoy, right?
Okay.
So I will start it out. It's called Ordination Rite. Ho, lo, he crept down, ferreting the earth and hollow, skulking usurper, feeding seraphs on tails. He sucked and sucked from the red river's cup till the puckered sack set agape, and the germ was laid, perpetual stain, rounding the sallow opening to the tunnel once pristine, where he left the wastrel chained.
Wow. Very strong stuff. Very strong stuff. You're a poet who deals with so many different arenas. I know you've treated of the poets of the Romantics. You've treated of historic figures of... Why don't you give our audience some sense of some of the subjects that you've treated, in addition to this personal one dealing with, should we say, abuse?
Well, you know, actually, just to lay the groundwork even further, I actually only have two books that I've written that were personal poetry. Uh-huh. Because I prefer actually not to write in that vein. The reason being that I think it takes less imagination. So most of what I've written have been work for historical figures. That being said, I've written for Petrarch, I have my 14-book romantic series, which is poetry from Wordsworth to Byron to Keats, all the way to the Blue Stocking writers of that era. Recently, I wrote a complimentary book for my first book, which was for Marie Antoinette, which is on Amazon, entitled Temple of Love, Poems for Marie Antoinette. Well, I wrote a compendium for that for Louis XVI. And currently, I'm actually writing a book for Joan of Arc.
Wow. You've treated these historical figures, and to my ear and my eye, you have used very much, I would say you captured the spirit of the time, if not quite writing in the vernacular per se. You didn't write in early French. You didn't write in early English. But you treat very much in that spirit and with a sensibility key to that time. You do remarkable work. It's almost historic poetry and historic poetic biography in a sense.
Well, that is the intention, but it's also to go beyond that and to bring the people who were who lived long ago to us today in a way that highlights the commonalities that we all have, and to bring them forth as not just figures in a history book, but as actual, real, sentient people who lived and breathed.
Yes, they're not kind of under glass. They're very much living, breathing people.
Exactly.
Some of the work that you did is just so amazing. I'm very much a student of history and enjoy historic writing very much myself. And I find it remarkable, some of the pieces that you've developed. Why don't you give our audience the titles again and what they treat on, and where can they get those? Are they all available on Amazon, for example?
Well, right now, because as I learned through painful process that, you know, it's really important to get your name out there and then to get an agent and then to publish. So right now what I have done is I have two books which are on Amazon, Blood, Bone, and Stone, which is the only other personal piece that I wrote, and Temple of Love. I also, though, do have poems in Light Journal, which is a poetry/photography magazine. I have the new one in the New York Anthology. I've had several in the Australian Times. So, you know, I'm out there, but what I'm trying to do is gather a voice, and so that I can actually get an agent and get all the other books that I have really published, because I have 26 books in total, but only two actually are published. And that's purposeful, because once you publish, especially self-publish, the people in the larger presses won't take you seriously. So it's really important to get your name and your voice out there.
That's really an interesting way of looking at it, and I think that's the first time I've heard an author think so carefully and strategically about how their work is released. Now, right now, these days you're living out in California. Did you experience any of the terrible, horrific fires that were out there? Did they impact the area where you live?
Very much so. We are 50 miles away from where the big fires were, but because they were so big and the wind gusts were so huge, the job that I have was closed for 2 days, and the sky was so red that the sun actually looked dark orange at one point. I had ash in my car, and we actually couldn't go outside for about 4 days because air was so thick with ash and pollutants.
Well, Aria, I know you're such a busy person, and you do educational support, and you're very involved in improving the way education is delivered, as well as your obviously rich, full writing life. Are you working on anything right now? I think you mentioned the Joan of Arc book.
Yes, right now I'm working on a book for Joan of Arc, and while I'm doing that, I'm reading biographies for her. The one that I'm reading right now is actually a piece of historical fiction, but it's really excellent. It's by Mark Twain, and it's called Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. And I find it very interesting because Mark Twain actually said that it was the one book that he actually felt the most proud of. So, and he said...
There was a little bit of noise on the line at that moment.
It's called Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc.
Wow. Now, does it treat her whole life, her life as a
yes.
warrior, as well as her trial, shall we say, by the Catholic Church?
Yes, it does. It starts out in the tiny village that she was born in, Domrey. It talks about her her and her friends. And Twain actually creates for himself a character who, by the way, has the same initials as Samuel Clemens, which is pretty funny. And he puts himself in her life and talks about the fairy tree that she had near where she grew up and how she would go and talk to the fairies. And then it goes to her getting her call from God to save France, to her being in the battles and leading the battles. And right now I'm at the actual part where they're in the trial and how the English actually tried to trick her into saying that she was not of God, but that she was of Satan. And it's really amazing to me because she was only 19 years old when she was put to the stake. And her answers are way beyond someone who would be 19 years old. They're just so profound.
Well, from all the versions that I've seen, she certainly was an inspired creature, that's for sure. It's always so enlightening talking with you, Aria. You are a real gift to literature. Any final thoughts you might want to leave with our audience? Maybe something you recommend they read, or at least they should certainly watch out for your new publication, both in the New York collection and then from the Light Poetry of Light.
Right. I would say really to, you know, go to Amazon if you can. The New York's Best Emerging Poets is the name of the book. It's New York's Best Emerging Poets Anthology. That's right. And, you know, you can actually download the book if you have the Kindle app for free and read it, which is what a lot of people have done. And if you want to write a review, go ahead. And I would also just say, you know, and this is what I tell everybody who wants to write, read. Read, 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 because reading is the best way to become a really good writer.
Well, Aria, as always, thank you so much. You are a gift to humanity, and I'm going to have to write one of those reviews myself.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Rick.
Okay, you take care and have a wonderful day. Bye-bye. Okay, that was Aria Ligi, a wonderful poet. I encourage you, if you enjoy poetry or you're a poet yourself, make sure you contact her, submit your work. It's a great place to go, and she has a great ear for poetry. So I highly, highly recommend it. And next up, an interview we did with Professor Wendy Lin Lee on the occasion of the current resident of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So here we go, Professor Wendy Lin Lee, and some campus threats to freedom of speech and attacks on professors. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking to Professor Wendy Lin Lee of Bloomington University, and we're going to talk a little bit about the America in 2017 as we approach the inauguration and anti-inauguration of the next president. And we've already kind of seen what the Republicans have planned for. And then, of course, we've watched them crash and burn right out of the box. So you know, there is help and hope in other spells, as the old saying goes. So tell me, it seems that
the interview there with the professor is the wrong one. So let me go ahead and play another piece, and I will we'll see if we can get the correct interview with the professor ready to go. I want to play an interview with you we did with Dennis Campbell. He is editor and publisher of the UK Progressive and also producer and host of the Three Muckrakers. So this is Dennis Campbell of the UK. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Dennis Campbell, author, reporter, progressive activist, and publisher of not only the UK Progressive, but also producer and host of the Three Muckrakers. Mr. Campbell, welcome, sir.
Thank you. Good to be back. We literally just finished recording this week's episode, which will be up Monday morning, first thing your time. So Sunday night is our big night for recording the podcast. And of course, our thoughts and prayers are now going out to the families of everybody in San Antonio. And here we are once again in another fatal multiple shooting incident. And it's just terribly frustrating that nothing can ever change.
Well, you know, if it was someone from out of the country, then nothing could restrain the rabid xenophobia. But since it's we don't know too much about it, so I don't want to chase that particular.
No, but I mean, it's interesting that 59 are killed by a disgruntled loner white man in Las Vegas a few weeks back, and now here we have, you know, what will likely turn out to be a similarly classified situation, and yet, you know, nothing will change, and it's too soon to talk about. But literally within seconds of Herr Trump knowing that the gentleman that was involved in the massive terrorist activity that killed 8 people and injured several in New York City was of the Muslim faith. It was, you know, Katie bar the door. We're going to give him the death penalty. We're going to send him to Guantanamo, and, you know, totally throwing apart their entire case in a matter of minutes.
Well, luckily, even though we may be without any diplomats in Asia, we've got the president with his carefully reasoned judgment over there to talk turkey, so to speak, with our friends in Asia. But let's talk about something important first.
Sure.
How's the book sales? And I imagine you've had plenty of opportunity to talk with people about the tome. And what kind of reaction you've been getting?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think most people are just so fed up with Donald Trump that they don't want to take the time to read about him. But the more people begin to look at how pathological this man is, the one thing that I've been saying now pretty much since the beginning, but really lead with in all discussions about the book, is you can never normalize him. This is what the Germans did to Hitler in the 1930s, and you need to have a detailed history of everything that has happened, and that's what we give you in the book. And you know, when I start that tone, I was on Nicole Sandler's show last week, and several others, and people begin to realize that we can't normalize this guy. We've got to find a way to make certain that we never forget. And my book does that. It helps you see from literally weeks before the campaign what happened, the actual election, the, you know, everybody has Mr. Comey down as this big hero, but the October surprise that was led by him and what happened as a result of it, the steady decline in the polls that led to the election victory for Trump, was just truly astonishing. And now, you know, from indictments being unsealed to even news today on Sunday that we've got, you know, Wilbur Ross now in the crosshairs for Russia dealings directly with the Putin family. This is the guy who's representing all commerce in the United States. And it looks like now that General Flynn is going to be indicted this coming week. So the noose is beginning to tighten. And I find it very interesting that he doesn't want to go anywhere near Pyongyang, which is the 39th parallel, which is where every president goes for a photo op, out of simple fear that some North Korean sniper is just going to take him out with a long rifle from a mile away. And, you know, and what better chance to rid the world at that point of the great Satan, as they would call him. So, you know, he's going to stay in South Korea, but you wonder how safe he's going to be and everybody there is going to be. I mean, the Washington Post came out this week with, you know, the whole scenario of what would happen in a war. They've got this cache of chemical and biological weapons and everything else. So, yeah, the book is now doing better. It's what we call in the industry a slow burn. You know, and it's growing, you know, I won't say by leaps and bounds, but, you know, more and more people are reading it. They're starting to comment and leave reviews on Amazon, which is good. And I think it's one of those that's going to be an interesting stocking stuffer. And but it's really going to continue to grow because we're also going to re-release the Egypt book in January, which is going to look back 7 years ago to the Egyptian Revolution, and then what has happened since. So it will...
Let me interrupt you there for a second before we get too far from the book. What is the title of the Trump book?
Donald Trump, Deplorable Bully is the title, and the subtitle is 45 Shameful Weeks of POTUS 45. And it is available on Amazon as a Kindle or a paperback or whatever your preferred form. And I'm going to do an audiobook probably in the next couple of weeks, so that will be ready for Christmas distribution as well.
Congratulations again.
Thank you.
Every success for you. It's a tremendous piece that you're working on there. Let's talk
Appreciate
about another issue. It seems that the Attorney General is being drawn into the vortex that is the Mueller investigation. More and more people are saying, yes,
you know, this is so funny because I literally had a quote in the script, and I'm opening it as we sit here and chat, because he's basically been caught lying to Congress now on three different occasions, and I wanted to make sure
and again, it
is just interesting. It is. You know, even Franken, who was brilliant, by the way, going after Facebook this week, went after Sessions this week for lying. And the quote was, in a normal Washington, the Attorney General would be out after all this, especially this isn't the first time he's been accused of misleading under oath. Indeed, Senator Jeff Sessions would have already called for the resignation of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. But in our politically paralyzed Washington, where the Trump White House and Senate Republicans are probably loath to have confirmation hearings for yet another attorney general, Sessions might be able to survive if he just begs for forgiveness. And that's the world that we're in. You know, if it had been Sessions had been a Democrat and had been a Democrat president, they would the drumbeat, you would be able to hear it in Korea right now for Sessions' head. But they just, you know, this on top of their tax bill and everything else, the hypocrisy is stunning. But at least people are seeing it now, and they're commenting on it now. So.
You mentioned hypocrisy and our good friends in Congress. I can't let that one go by without mentioning the good, well, let's just say the thorough work that the Republicans are doing with that tax bill. They managed to confront, annoy, sabotage, stab all so many constituencies. It takes real work to be that thorough.
Yeah, we went through the winners and losers on the podcast tonight, and it is truly astonishing because basically they define middle class as anybody earning $450,000 a year. And I'm thinking, wow, that's kind of, you know, maybe they just added an extra zero on the end there because, you know, that would be, but it was just one of those moments where you're sitting there and think, you know, $450,000 a year, they are totally clueless. But part of the problem is they don't know how to legislate. They don't know how to write a bill. The last bill they wrote was the Medicare giveaway under W. Bush. And that was the last significant piece of legislation that Republicans created, crafted, and did for themselves. And again, a huge giveaway that blew a hole in the budget, and they only care about the budget when it affects them, when it affects, you know, what it is they want to do. And, you know, here we are once again staring down the barrel of the gun.
Well, You know, speaking in terms of political nightmares, because of course that's what the Republicans are dialing up for themselves over in Congress, let's talk for just a minute about the savaging the Democratic Party's been getting lately. What do you think? In terms of Donna Brazile, do you think what the checks stopped coming? I mean, interesting, take a shot at the guy that brung you. I mean,
well,
I'm puzzled here.
I don't think that, you know, I've known Donna for years, Donna Brazile, and she's, you know, she's a very savvy operator. She knows how to sell books, and that's what's exactly going to happen as a result of this. But the one thing I keep telling people, particularly the supporters of Bernie and anybody else, that you have to understand one thing. Political parties exist for but one purpose, to protect the party, full stop. Now, no, I don't like the way Bernie was treated. I don't like the way it went down. And at the end of the day, that's the job of a political party. The guy wasn't a Democrat. So there's no way the party is going to give him carte blanche if he's not even going to join the party for whom he wants to stand. They've got one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to preserve the party. And you and I have been over this many times. I'm not surprised by any of this that is happening. I'm not surprised that she's thrown the party under the bus, because she's making a nice living as a commentator, and, you know, she doesn't need the DNC. You know, she stood in, you know, when Debbie Wasserman Schultz imploded. And I don't see anything wrong with anything that she has brought up. And the simple fact is that this was all done back in 2015. So what's the big freaking deal?
Well, let me put it to you this way. Evidently, the party sort of has a love-hate relationship with the good Senator Sanders. They did bring him on tour there. Seemed to think that he was doing something good for him. But that's neither here nor there. I think the practical matter is we have to find some way of... I want to get your reactions, because this is sort of conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom says, by God, you know, we've got to get together, and you know, that the only thing they can say good about the Democratic Party is the only thing they have is they're against Trump. It's not a bad thing. You know, that is a unifying principle. And when we see George Bush gaining credibility in comparison to the dumpster, it's a funny world.
It is, and I think there's going to be some very big Democratic wins next Tuesday during the elections, and I think that is going to be a huge shot fired across the bow of Trump. Now, he'll try to, you know, basically say, look, there was no way we were going to win either of those states, blah, 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 blah. But I'm seeing and hearing more and more moderate Republicans washing their hands of him because they just don't know what to do with him. I mean, he's just, you know, there are times, and I saw this last week on the Daily Show with Trevor Noah, where Hillary Clinton came out and she said, you know, there are times when the president has to be the national consoler in chief, you know, and she talked about how Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and all the incidents that they had, you know, George W. Bush was with her when she was a senator on the pile, 2001, in the affected city of New York. And, you know, she said, look, presidents rise above or need to rise above the situation to become the consoler in chief in that moment, to be the standard bearer, to be the one shoulder that the nation can cry on. And what does Trump do is he turns everything into political infighting, nastiness, and it just goes on and on. And that's the reason I wrote
Justice Department.
Well, he doesn't have an empathetic bone in his body, and that's the main reason why I wrote the book. It was to say, look, you know, this man is he's an absolute monster. He doesn't know how to console somebody. I mean, the death toll in Puerto Rico is ridiculous and just climbing. Nobody knows how many people have power, but it's consistently gone down, the number. I mean, he gives a $300 million contract to the island of Puerto Rico to two guys in Montana operating out of a post office box in a storefront. And, you know, Puerto Rico says, look, we don't want you guys because what you're charging us is ridiculous. And, you know, they were making money hand over fist. And it's so corrupt and it is so venal right now. It's just a matter of time before it all blows up in his face. And it's starting to.
Well, thank you so much, my friend.
My pleasure.
Tell them how to listen to the Muckrakers podcast.
It's called The Three Muckrakers, and you can find it on iTunes. But it's definitely on iTunes podcast. And episode 139 will be live tomorrow as you're on your way to work. And, you know, we'll be able to chat a little bit more about that. We have a Facebook page, facebook.com/3muckrakers. So come on over and say hello.
Well,
thank you, sir.
My friend, nice to talk to you. Take care.
Same here. Bye-bye now.
Daughters of Isis is the ancestor of aromacology, indigenous scents representing the fragrant memories of our ancestors, to provide us the tools of the inner quest, the authentic moment, and to heal the Earth Mother. Daughtersofisis.com. Wholesale available also. Mention PNN and enjoy a free sample from our apothecary. For your aromatherapy needs, that's daughtersofisis.com.
Okay, next up we're going to hear, this is Rob Abstin's take on the recent Florida Democratic Party event, and he couldn't appear, so what we did was we hired one of our robots to go ahead and read his essay. This is Rob Abstin's essay on the recent Florida Democrats convention. Here we go.
Thoughts from the Florida Democratic Convention. October 27th to 29th, 2017. Here we are. It's Florida, 2017, and we have survived 8 years of Rick Scott. That is to say that some of us, maybe most of us, have survived Rick Scott. There is no way to know how many mothers who lacked access to health care because of Scott's callous rejection of $18 billion from the federal government to provide health care to those mothers, succumbed to diseases that could have been prevented with the proper care. There is no way to know how many children have suffered, still suffer, or have perhaps died because Medicaid funds were not available to pay for preventive or urgent care. What we do know is that there are over 1 million people in Florida living at the poverty line who cannot afford health care, cannot receive subsidies for insurance under the ACA, and live every day just a paycheck away from homelessness, unable to go to the doctor for a checkup where a debilitating disease might be discovered while it is treatable and inexpensive to do so. This is Florida in 2017. This is America, arguably the richest nation on the planet. I am at home reflecting on the weekend I just spent at the Florida Democratic Convention. I watched a forum for three gubernatorial candidates who, I assume, are considered by the party to be the most likely candidates to win in the Democratic primary in 2018. I watched the Florida delegation pass a package of resolutions stating the party's position on a number of timely and important issues facing Floridians in this turbulent time in our lives and the lives of our friends and neighbors. I had personal, one-on-one conversations with two of the candidates for governor from the Candidates Forum, and with a third candidate who was unhappy about being left out of the debate. I met young Dems and old Dems, excited Dems and frustrated Dems, and Dems of many race, creeds, color, and gender. At the end of the day, or weekend to be more precise, I concluded that Dems are ready to govern in Florida for many years to come. My takeaways from the convention are: the Dems have fielded three great candidates for governor, each with her or his own strengths and weaknesses. Dems are already being elected to office across Florida in municipalities and counties where it would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago. The chair of the FDP is much more democratic than I gave him credit for during his election to the chair this past year. I was particularly impressed with Chairman Biddle's personal efforts to take food, supplies, and generators to Puerto Rico following hurricane to lend direct aid to folks in an urgent situation who offer no particular political or other benefit. The Florida Dems demonstrated a very progressive tendency that I found a bit surprising at the state level by enacting a series of resolutions including such things as support for recognition of health care as a human right, an end to the education-for-profit industry that puts profits above our children's education, an end to prisons for profit that encourages putting Floridians in jail rather than ensuring justice for all, restoration of rights to felons upon serving their time and paying their debt to society, a rebuke to the anti-immigrant policies of the current administration, and an affirmation of our American principles, including a more compassionate immigration policy that places a priority on family reunification, a path to citizenship for the Dreamers, and respect for human rights regardless of a person's immigration status. Promoting responsible gun ownership that recognizes our civic responsibility to keep guns out of the hands of people who have demonstrated an incapacity to use guns responsibly because of mental illness or a history of domestic violence, and treating drug addiction as a medical problem rather than a criminal one. A progressive community within the Democratic Party remains angry, hurt, and often bitter because of the treatment given to Bernie Sanders during the last election cycle. An attempt to influence the party to move to open primaries so that NPAs would feel more welcome in the party was turned away. I am more optimistic today about the direction of the Democratic Party than I was before the convention. I believe we have a great deal more to do to provide an infrastructure that supports inclusion, empowerment, and provides a path to success in future elections, but we have taken a big step forward. While the party still seems to obsess over fundraising, I see a real recognition of the need for organizing at the grassroots. Don't get me wrong. We have always asked our people to knock on doors and make phone calls. What I have not seen in the past is the official recognition of a job well done. We recognized those county organizations who knocked on the most doors, made the most phone calls, created the best signs for the convention, and had the best Halloween costumes. I am also pleased that we did not move toward open primaries. I have seen too much hanky-panicky in states where they have tried that approach. I am disappointed that the wounds of the last election seem to linger so strongly. Most of all, I am thrilled that we will elect a new governor in 2018 and feel confident that we will elect a Democrat this time.
Well, there you go. That was Rob, as read by our friendly robot. Let me play this for all of you working class heroes in the middle class earning $450,000 a year, as say the Republicans.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow the rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. when they tortured and scared you for 20-odd years. Then they expect you to pick a career when you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. Think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. First you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Progressive News Network, a new Mercury Media production, where you'll find the voices of activists, the voices of those working to make this a better world. We believe that as we face challenging times, the human spirit can face and surmount the foolish and the short-sighted. Tune in every Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, for the live show, or anytime you can. Progressive News Network, found at www.newmercurymedia.com/PNN/. We have a future. Tune in and build it with us. Underwritten by Florida Media Labs, produced by Rick Spivak in cooperation with Canary and a Coal Mine Films. Progressive News Network.
Well, I'm going to close with the piece by Joanne Foreman from her Unsung Heroes. This is a story of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory that had such a big impact on the working life of people at the turn of the century.
Here's a song for the unsung working women who worked for America. Here's a song for the unsung. Look, look, Francis Perkins, all on a March afternoon.
When the sirens of fire engines tore across Washington Park in New York City's Greenwich Village, it was March 25, 1911, and the Triangle Shirtwaist Building was on fire. Gathering up her long skirt, Frances Perkins saw the bundles of cloth were sailing from the windows, and then realized in horror that the bundles were 145 people, mostly girls and women, falling to death. It was a scene that Frances Perkins never forgot. Born in April 1880 to a very proper Boston family, Frances Perkins not only had the temerity to be intelligent and questioning, but also committed the unforgivable sin of not being pretty. she was allowed to attend college because it was assumed that she would not marry and would have to earn her own living. She was part of that high-minded generation of women who melded the work of labor organizing with many-faceted social work of the era, settling immigrants, attacking child labor, horrendous working conditions, and the terrible problems of the poor, who, of course, were the people who did the work. Frances did marry, after all, and produce a daughter, but her husband was an alcoholic and spent most of his life in sanitariums and mental hospitals. It is symptomatic that, unlike most women of her time, she kept her maiden name. In 1911, in addition to not yet having the vote, the only road to influence for women was through men. And Frances spent years patiently cementing working relationships with the politicians of the era. Understanding the need to appear non-threatening, she adopted the look she kept from her 30s until her death at 85, modest dresses and suits, dark colors and pearls, always a hat. Her most important contact was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and when he became president, he appointed her the first woman cabinet member in history of the United States as Secretary of Labor. She once said that it should be Secretary for Labor, and in the depths of the Great Depression, with Roosevelt firmly behind her, she wrote the Unemployment Insurance Act, Social Security Act, and other programs we now, hopefully, can take for granted. The atmosphere of the times also promoted union membership, which expanded fivefold during the 1930s. Though she cultivated a low-key demeanor, there was one attempt to impeach her, a first for a cabinet officer. It went nowhere, but it did not make her life easier. When Roosevelt died suddenly in April 1945 and Harry Truman became president, she knew it was time for her to go. Her last day was July 1st, 1945. Today, it's not so unusual for women to serve in the cabinet. Frances Perkins paved the way. Tune in next time for the life of Emma Tanayuka. Songs for the Unsung is a project of user-friendly music, script, narrative, and original music by Joanne Foreman, sung by Jenny Bird.
Well, friends, this last piece tonight I dedicate to those who would shut down the EPA. It's Warren Zevon's Straight Down. And with that, my friends, I say good night till next week. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Rick Spezak, host and producer of Progressive News Network, signing off.